From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Almost a decade ago, Primer, a low-budget, mind-bending sci-fi film about a group of engineers who accidentally create a time machine, took Sundance by storm. The man behind the film, Shane Carruth, turned filmmaking into a one-man show, writing, directing, composing the score, co-starring in the film. But just as everyone was poised for more, he more or less disappeared for 9 years. Until now, he's out with a new film, Upstream Color. It is powerful, enigmatic, almost a poem in film, with dark themes of mind control and strange science, but also of love, with Thoreau's Walden thrown in. This hour on Point, Shane Carruth and his new film, Upstream Color. You can join us on air or online. Have you seen Primer? Are you waiting for Upstream Color? How do you see a filmmaker like Shane Carruth? Join us anytime digitally at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Here's a little bit from the trailer for Upstream Color. Two central characters, Chris, played by Amy Simetis, and Jeff, played by the film's writer and director, Shane Carruth, as they try to understand the mysterious experiences they've had and how they found one another.
Do you know this place?
I want to say yes.
Go in there! Just go in there!
For you. I want to.
I haven't slept at all!
Is there a direction that you feel drawn?
I'm going to go wherever you go. You know that.
It's a story almost beyond telling, a kind of poem and film. Thoreau's, Henry David Thoreau's Walden comes into play late in the film. Somehow, she knows a lot of it. Here are the two again.
He heard a low and distant sound, but grand and impressive, unlike anything he had ever heard.
Gradually swelling and increasing.
As if it would have a universal and memorable ending.
A sullen Russian roar.
The rays which stream through the shutter.
Will be no longer remembered when the shutter is wholly removed.
The finest qualities of our nature.
Like the blue moon fruits can be preserved.
A stream flowing out in that direction through a wooded valley.
But stream there was none.
I am glad to have drunk water so long.
For the same reason that I prefer the natural sky.
From Upstream Color, directed and much more by Shane Carruth. It's had quite a reception. Small rollout, but it's still coming, and you will hear more about it. Richard Brody writes in The New Yorker, the thematic and tonal continuity between Primer and Upstream Color, remarkable. It says Carruth works in a distinctive mode, science fiction with overtones of transcendence. His distinctive visual style is one of spiritual impressionism, similar to that of Terrence Malick's agile, luminous rapture, but Carruth's images are harder-edged, more confrontational, and above all, non-religious. Shane Carruth joins us now from Dallas, Texas, film writer, director, actor, composer, producer. His new film, Upstream Color, premiered at Sundance in January. It's in select theaters around the country now. You can find the trailer for the film at our website, onpointradio.org. His first film, Primer, released in 2004, has been an indie cult hit for years. Shane Carruth, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Tom. Yeah, this is really wonderful. That was quite a build-up. Thank you.
Well, it's quite a film, and it is by no means your everyday fare. I have to say, I really loved this, and I loved how quickly you put my film-watching experience into an atypical realm. There's something just in the first seconds of the film that says, don't watch this in your ordinary way, but that's all right. Sort of, come on, come along with this.
Right.
How do you do that, Shane?
How do you do that? Oh, wow. I don't know. Everything that I have ever tried to do winds up being the equivalent of digging a ditch with a spoon, where it starts off as menial tasks, and then before long they start to add up, and things get more and more complex, and there's a storm of things. And I mean, essentially, I only can write or make or do whatever for an audience that is roughly representative of me. It's what I would like to see when I have experiences in watching film that really move me or change the way that I think about things or even the way that I think about film, those are the most powerful moments. And so that's what I aim to get to. So
As I watched this, I found myself thinking, yes, I'm watching a film, but in a way I'm watching a poem. And maybe that's just naturally the way you work, but it's so, yes, there is a narrative, though it is enigmatic in the extreme, but it's so emotionally and visually centered and so kind of roundabout. I mean, how do you begin? Is it sequential, or are you pulling pieces together like a jigsaw on the table?
Absolutely. No, it is. Here's the thing. The way that I think about it, and what's funny is this is not something I've had to verbalize until I had to start verbalizing it and talking about it. But the way that I think about it is, my hope is that there is an architecture at the center of this story and Primer that is so solid so sound that it could potentially be repurposed in all sorts of other forms, in the same way that fables can be. I always go back to the simplest thing, is, you know, the tortoise and the hare, that idea. Mm-hmm. That could be told in a million different ways, whether it's, you know, a story or a book or a film or a play or whatever. Like, that central conceit is consistent. And because it's so solid and because it holds all the exploration within it, my hope is that with Upstream Color, its core is sound, or hopefully as sound as that. And so because of that, exploring it through the medium of film, we can do it much more lyrically. We have the freedom to define the edges of the exploration lyrically and in a flowing way, instead of a rote, by the numbers, straightforward way. And there's a lot of other elements at play too. This mm-hmm. film is, even the plot is so much about characters being affected by things they can't speak to, and so much of it is nonverbal. And we really do get into a mode where we're conveying their subjective experience. So that also makes it, you know, a bit more lyrical, or I guess veiled technically, than you would necessarily see from another kind of story.
Kenneth Turan writes about your film Upstream Color. He calls it as enigmatic as filmmaking gets. But he says, and this is very true, but not in a casual way. It is determinedly, even willfully. So, I mean, the plot points in here are hard to even pin down, but there are larvae, there are orchids, there's some kind of chemical concoction here. We see kids drinking this bug juice and then acting in unison as though under mind control, a young woman who has these larvae under her skin. You've got that knife that she has to get him out. I always wonder why directors use the huge, you know, it's a sort of psycho scale knife, not right. something you might actually use for that kind of work. Right. And then meets another character, yourself, who appears to have fallen somehow under this same sort of malignant mind control. They've got revelations. We've got a pig farm involved. All right, we've got lots of elements flying around here and very powerful, enigmatic, lyrical images. You bring up the tortoise and the hare. Now, the architecture of that, you know, slow and steady wins the race. Simple as
right.
that.
Right.
What is your central conceit?
Well, this is, I'm glad that we're talking about this in terms of two people that have, you've seen the film and I've seen the film, obviously.
Yeah.
Because this is something, I don't know, this is... I like to be able to talk about this after the fact and not use this as the supposed synopsis that's meant to compel people to watch the film or not. But basically, I mean, at its core, we have characters that started off in one place and had their narrative stripped from them. They had their identity and everything that made them taken away. Mm-hmm. And they wake up and look around and have to atone for what kind of person they must be to have done the things that it looks like they did. And they have to, they embrace that new version of themselves and try to carry forward with that. And that is the basic core of this story. Is we are embarking on an exploration of all the things that can be part of our subjective experience, and getting to the question of if you start stripping away these layers and regrowing them wrong, is there anything fundamental? Is there a core underneath all of this that stays true regardless of what you strip away? And the film is not interested in answering that concretely, but I think it does a really thorough job of getting to the the far edges of that question. And so it necessarily gets us into a mode of being elliptical and hopefully, fortunately, veiled, because we've got, I mean, look, we've got a woman here who is going to be pushed to the brink. She is experiencing emotions and mania without anything to point to explain where those are coming from. And in this film, without, you know, saying exactly what it is, she gets pushed to what I imagine to be the most severe emotion, and then has to, you know, and reaches a breaking point to get us to the last third of this film, where we are almost in a space where we are experiencing nothing but subtext and emotion and sheer will and a follow through on the momentum that's been building up into that point.
This is On Point. We're talking this hour with film writer, director, producer, actor, composer Shane Carruth. He's back after almost a decade after his dazzling sci-fi premiere Primer won big at Sundance. His new mind-bending sci-fi romance, with one foot in something like terror and one in Thoreau's Walden, is Upstream Color. You can hear behind us right now another piece from that score, composed by Shane Carruth, this one entitled Fearing That They Would Be Lightheaded for Want of Food and Also Sleep. The title's a quote from Henry David Thoreau's Walden, which makes recurring appearances in the film. In Upstream Color, there's a scene where the thief, played by Thiago Martins, tells a hypnotized, apparently Chris, played by Amy Semetis, what she is and is not allowed to do.
I was born with a disfigurement where my head is made of the same material as the sun. It makes it impossible for you to look directly at me. It has always been this way. The water before you is somehow special. When you drink it, you feel revived and full of energy. It is better than anything you've ever tasted. Take a drink now.
That's one of the longest bits of dialogue, if you can call it that, in the film. Lots of images, but a little back and forth. Here the character Jeff, played by my guest Shane Carruth, starts playing a game with Chris, Amy Semetis, on a train, imagining the life stories of fellow passengers, only to have Chris turn the game around and begin guessing at his life story.
You see this woman here with the knitting? She's a former senator, right? Like a Nobel winner. But her category is mittens. So she rides a what?
You lost me. It just got a little too...
A
little cute, here. Yeah.
I don't know. What do you have in mind?
All right. How about that guy?
Tell me about him.
He's divorced.
Yeah. Yep.
Because she cheated? No? No. Oh, he did. He cheated. No. How was it? Alcoholic. Some substance of some kind.
From Upstream Color, director Shane Carruth is with us, and of course he produced and co-starred in, and, well, just about everything. His goal, writes Kenneth Turan, is to be effective just outside our rational understanding. He wants us not to know, but to feel. We're at 800-423-8255. Shane, you studied math and worked in computer programming. When did you get the film bug? How did you know that you would or that you needed to express yourself in film?
Yeah, this is something I fell in love with math in college and pursued that. And at the same time was tripping into writing and trying to figure out how that worked. And so I would work on short stories and was working on a novel at one point before getting into screenplays because they were more appropriate to what I was writing, which was typically only the things that you could observe if you were in the room with somebody. And so, you know, I got out of school. I didn't know how to make money really in doing either of my passions, which would be, you know, writing or music or math. And took a job as a software engineer because it's something I could do with my degree and mm-hmm. it paid the bills and I could continue trying to figure out what I would be doing. And so that was a pretty short period in my life before I jumped off and tried to make a film. And that ended up being Primer. So I've benefited a lot, I think, from that story of software engineer turns filmmaker. But the reality was is I think I was always headed towards some sort of writing, and just was paying the bills with that job.
Primer, of course, got this huge reception at Sundance, Grand Jury Award there over Napoleon Dynamite and Garden State, and great hosannas, lots of comparisons to Terrence Malick, but then you, like he for a long time, kind of dropped out of sight. What were you working on this film all that time? What's been up, Shane?
No, yeah, I got it in my, you know, that what you're describing there, that's typically the time where a filmmaker goes to LA and they start taking meetings and, you know, they get attached to some project or, you know, you mm-hmm. do something to make a name for yourself. And
you've shown that you've got the chops. Now let's put you in a vehicle we can really roll with, Shane.
Exactly. Yeah.
You resisted that.
Well, I did. Luckily, it doesn't really matter to me because I didn't get into writing to do that. And so what I was trying to figure out is it didn't seem like there was probably a lot of common ground between what I want to do and the way that they want it to be done. But I thought maybe there's some common ground. And the short version of what's been going on for the last 9 years is that I've just been finding out that there isn't even a sliver of common ground. I invested a lot of time of myself and energy into a project called Atopiary. It was it's an original script that I put together, and it involves, you know, 10 kids that are basically given the ability to craft creatures made out of these rudimentary pieces. And there was a whole life cycle to it and how it worked, and it needed to fit a certain aesthetic in my mind because it really was trying to be something new. It's not, you know, you couldn't say they were aliens or robots or anything like that. It really was just something brand new. And that, it was important to me because so much of the subtext of the film was dependent on it, the way the cycle would work. Anyway, so I invested a lot of time in that and in design. And then I wanted to make sure that the effects for it were consistent as well and had met a certain aesthetic. And so I went way too far down the rabbit hole of trying to solve that. And so I put all that together in a way that I thought was satisfying and went out and to see if I could get it financed. And it took a while to realize that even though everyone was meeting it with enthusiasm, nothing was actually transpiring. Nothing was moving forward. And so it essentially broke my heart or that the thinking that could happen. And I was just really fortunate that at the same time, some of the story elements for Upstream Color were coming together. And I eventually reached a point where I was so passionate with what Upstream became and what it was becoming that I couldn't really see anything else anyways, and I just had to put the other project aside.
Is there a support structure for a filmmaker like you in American film, or are you basically on your own, Shane?
I think there is. I haven't solved it. I know that there seems to be filmmakers out there that are doing really interesting things, and they seem to be backed by money. I haven't solved that problem. I only know how to do it one way. And so that's, you know, luckily I know some great people in Dallas who were willing to go along with this. And we just went ahead and made the film without engaging or that process or pitching or trying to convince Film Finance to do anything. We just went and did it.
it's so thrilling to see a filmmaker out there. It must be hard, but with that independence, you can come up with something that is not like the rest, and it's incredibly refreshing. Here's a little bit from Shane Carruth's 2004 Primer. Portrays Aaron, one of the engineers who discover a way to travel through time. Here are Aaron's last words in the film.
My voice is the only proof that you will have of the truth of any of this. I might have written the letter with my signature, but my handwriting is not what it used to be. Maybe you've had the presence of mind to record this. That's your prerogative. You will not be contacted by me again.
Good morning. Every half meter, placez les chaque demi-mètre, everywhere, partout, everywhere.
And if you look,
partout,
you will not find me.
You will not find me. Primer with lots of big fans. Shane Carruth with us today from Dallas, Texas. Christine is calling right now from Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Hi, Christine. You're on the air. Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Well, I'm really enjoying the conversation. And basically, I'm sorry to say that I had never heard of Shane Carruth until I heard you talking about him. And I'm very excited. The conversation has really convinced me that what he's created is a work of vision and conviction, and it's exciting. So I hope it's showing in Boston.
It is. Hey, all right.
Coolidge. Yeah, we've been at the Brattle, and now we're at Coolidge.
And Christine, you're ready to sit down in the theater and not have anything like a normal narrative structure. Let yourself be kind of swept away with images and fragments.
I can't wait. So this weekend.
All right. Enjoy. I thought it was just terrific. Christine, thanks for calling. Shane, please stand by in Dallas. Mark Olson is with us right now. He's an indie film writer at the Los Angeles Times. He's thought a lot about you and your films. Mark Olson, it's great to have you with us. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So you know Primer. You know Upstream Color. What do you see in the path of Shane Carruth?
It's interesting. I mean, Shane is both entirely his own, you know, model and filmmaker, and yet there are other filmmakers he's not entirely, you know, separate from. Mm-hmm. He does have a sort of a small handful of people that might be considered, you know, collaborators or colleagues. And so the extent to which he's kind of forging his own path is, I think, the thing that's most exciting about what he's been doing, this sort of mysterious mystique of where he's been all this time, and then this just explosive reemergence that he's had since January, since the buildup began for the film premiering first at Sundance and then with the commercial release.
Who would you see in that circle that might be linked to Shane, Mark?
Well, there's a filmmaker named David Lowry who collaborated with Shane on Upstream Color. He was Shane's co-editor on mm-hmm. the film. And David also had a film that premiered at Sundance. It was called Ain't Them Body Saints that starred Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. And oddly, David was just announced as he's going to be involved with a remake of the Disney film Pete's Dragon. And then there's another filmmaker named Ryan Johnson who's working sort of on a bigger budget level, but is also making in some ways sort of these very heady genre films that sort of are twisting our expectations of storytelling. And then, I mean, some of the people might even be unexpected. I mean, you mentioned Terrence Malick earlier, and, you know, curiously, here in Los Angeles, Upstream Color and the new film by Terrence Malick, To the Wonder, opened on the same day. And so it was quite easy if one wanted, you could have hopped from theater to theater and created quite the heady double bill.
Shane, what do you think when you hear yourself spoken of in the same breath as Terrence Malick? Do you feel you're in the same neck of the woods in terms of filmmaking? Do you recognize a fellow traveler there?
No, I don't know how to process that information, to be honest. I think his name has become synonymous with a certain approach to cinematography where it's lyrical and it's mm-hmm. it's much more interested in tone than narrative. But talking about David Lowry as well, his work for Ain't Them Body Saints has been compared to Malick as well, and there's several others. It just seems to be sort of a thing that can be said, and then everybody knows exactly what we're talking about. But I don't think anybody thinks that I'm working on that level.
I don't know about that. I think you're working on a pretty fine level. I'm not sure how to describe it. Mark, I've taken a little whack at a taste of the story that runs through Upstream Color. I'd be grateful to hear you try that as well. How do you describe, if people ask, what's it about, which is your sort of opening question about so many films?
Well, first of all, I would sort of want to just say that it's I think, easy to make the film sound a lot more intimidating and a lot more difficult to process mm-hmm. than it actually is. That for me, one of the things I find most exciting about Upstream Color is simply the fact that I think it is the film that you want it to be. However you approach it, however you want to engage with it, it's sort of almost like a living organism can respond back to you. And
yes.
So the part of, I think, what Shane is doing, and I think it's somewhat what, you know, David Lowery or, you know, Terrence Malick in To the Wonder and even the recent Harmony Korine film Spring Breakers, which what Harmony has described as a liquid narrative, I think there's a storytelling style there that's meant to, in some ways, move, it maybe sounds, you know, over the top, but beyond language in some way. That I think it's quite instructive, I think, that the last maybe third or so of Upstream Color, there's not a lot of talking in like a dialogue sense, but yet you're still getting a lot of story information, a lot of things are still happening, and I think part of what's being done there is the film is in some ways trying to become something more pure and to in some sense become a pure emotion. I think it's kind of bypassing the head to try to get straight to the heart so that you're like feeling the movie in a much more than maybe you are like thinking or processing the movie.
We've got people who have seen Upstream Color calling. I want to go to them. Mark, Shane, please stand by. Michael in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Michael, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Shane. I just wanted to say thanks so much, Shane, for this film. I loved it. I saw it at the Brattle the other night. And it's exactly the kind of filmmaking that I just love to see, where the story isn't dictated, but it allows, you know, us to sink into it in so many different ways. I found myself in so many different places watching the film, and it was just really, really enjoyable.
I'm so glad to hear that. Thank you.
It's great. Michael, if somebody asks you after having seen it, what is that film? What do you say to them?
I don't know how much I've had a chance to process fully. It has a very, you know, surreal feel to me, in the sense that, you know, kind of what you, it meets me where I, you know, with what I bring, you know, to the film. It's about love, relationship. It's about life. It's about the universe. It's tremendously visual, which I love. I'm a photographer. So, and it just put me in the mind of other films that have been really special to me in a way, in that way, and that it doesn't, again, I guess it doesn't dictate, you know, the story, you know, so, but definitely hard to put words on for me, I think, at this point. I just saw it about two nights ago.
Yeah, no question about it. You bring a lot to it yourself, but there's a lot going on that screen as well in Upstream Color, all the way from the bugs, the larva under the skin, to mysterious pig farm and tones rising from the earth. And of course, Henry David Thoreau's Walden being cited throughout. Michael, thank you for calling. Mark Olson with the LA Times, please stand by in Los Angeles. And Shane Carruth, writer, director, producer, actor, composer of the score of the new film Upstream Color, with us from Dallas this hour. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with film writer, director, producer, actor, composer, Shane Carruth. He's back almost a decade after his dazzling sci-fi premiere, Primer, won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. His new mind-bending sci-fi romance is Upstream Color. Joins us today from Dallas, Texas, and with us from Los Angeles is Mark Olson, indie film writer at the Los Angeles Times. Shane, here's Jacqueline. Saw the film, Upstream Color. Question for you. She asks, how do you see your work fit in with contemporary science fiction?
Oh, wow. Contemporary science fiction. That's specific. I don't know. I don't know what contemporary science fiction is, to be honest. Here's what I know. The thing that's the most most important to me is that a work have a chance to be relevant in the future. That I'm not saying that everything that I do is important enough to be relevant, but if I ever suspect for a second that what I'm doing is too temporary and has no chance, then I have to change or stop. And that's the only terms in which I think of when it comes to narrative. There are people that say Upstream is science fiction, others that don't. I don't really care to argue with them either way. I wouldn't call it science fiction, but that's mainly because I feel like science fiction has become more of an aesthetic and not what I thought it was meant to be for, which was a set of shortcuts into an exploration, narrative tools to use in the same way that the Greeks used mythology to shortcut into different aspects of humans and what's universal about us. So I don't know. I don't know where we are with contemporary science fiction.
That's a pretty good response, though. Mark, do you see science fiction here or just kind of non-standard shortcuts to take us to psychological depths?
Well, I think with Upstream Color, we as an audience are sort of reading it as science fiction, in part based off of Primer, which had a time travel aspect to it and was sort of easier to understand through the lens of science fiction. I think with Upstream Color, there is science in the film, mm-hmm. and it is fiction, so it's hard not to call it science fiction, mm-hmm. but it also is so many other things at the same time. I mean, most specifically, it's very much a romance, and I think for one of the easiest ways to understand the film is simply as a romance, and in some ways the story is simply about how when each of us fall in love with someone else, there's almost like a mutual insanity that you agree to, and that you and your partner are sort of become crazy together a little bit and go on a sort of a shared journey. And so there, science fiction that is tricky, exactly as Shane was saying. It implies a larger aesthetic that's just not operating in Upstream Color. So it is science fiction, but it also is not science fiction.
Here's the character Chris, again played by Amy Semedes, and Jeff, played by my guest Shane Carruth, in the film Upstream Color, talking about how this mysterious substance that he's consumed, as had she, ruined his first marriage.
I would think that there's some marriages that could survive something like that. Maybe.
Maybe, but
not yours.
Not ours, no. From her perspective. I mean, everything just flipped, The guy she thought she married turned out to be somebody else, a junkie. And all the savings, all the plans, everything resets. The lights turn on, and I'm holed up in some hotel across town.
From Upstream Color, Laura's calling. Hi, Laura, you're on the air with Shane Carruth.
Hi. This sounds like a very enjoyable and heady film. I'm curious as to whether doing some rereading of Walden Pond or reading of would be helpful to increase the understanding and or enjoyability of the film.
We'll put it right to show. How about it, Shane? You got this trope. I don't know if it's essential or you just happen to run across the book when you're making the film. Is it essential?
Right. Here's the thing. This is not something I should admit because I could definitely spin this up. But the reality is Walden is basically raw material for this film. And the film is not necessarily a reaction to transcendentalism or anything that Thoreau was talking about. There are some really, really bizarre coincidences that we found when we got into production or right up into production. And those have been exploited, but mainly to service the film, the narrative. The bottom line is there is a life cycle in this film that is, it was important to me that it be something that has been around as long as we have, and that it be not a foreign thing that's been inserted into where we are, but that it's just outside our experience, but that it's always been here. So it necessarily becomes part of the natural world. And so we are talking about worms and beasts and flora and soil and water and the way that sound works underwater and light as a presence. All of these things are part of both the plot and the way that the cinematic mode shifts to convey, you know, a presence of ominousness or whatever else. So we're already sort of in that language. And then there's a bit of plot up front where Chris is forced to write and rewrite every page from a piece of literature. And so I needed to pick a piece of literature. So what is this thing? And so I get Walden because, you know, my recollection from high school was that this is a very dry work and that it wouldn't, you know, if somebody's under a state of suggestion the way that Chris is, it wouldn't be something that would rile her up or wake her up. And it also has a ton of language having to do with, you know, peacefulness and the natural world. And so, great, that seems really appropriate. But all of the weird elements that are in the film that are there based on their own, I mean, their own merit to service the plot, I started going through Walden and looking for just a bit of prose and was really struck by how often the language in there was way too appropriate for the film. There are lines when Chris reaches a state later in the film, she's essentially in a fugue state, or she's just a broken person and is going through these menial tasks at the pool. And she can only speak lines from Walden. The lines that we picked for her to speak were lines that, because she's internalized this work, they're lines that would also be common to her experience. So she's talking about, you know, I shouldn't go too far into it, but everything that she's saying is something that she's experienced in the film, but it also happens to be a line from Walden. So we definitely keyed into that and played that up. But no, I don't think reading Walden or understanding Thoreau is essential to this film, or vice versa.
It's surely evocative, that sort of a call and response when she's in the pool in her fugue state, as you say, with the finest qualities of our nature, like the blue moon fruits can be preserved.
It's crazy. There's so many commonalities, and you know the film does a lot with two specific colors, with blue and with yellow. And then, you know, there's a line in Walden which talks about blue mixed with prevailing yellow of the sand. We've got, you know, a character who's essentially a pig farmer who has a corral of pigs that he uses in a specific way. And then so we'll use a line like, you know, a menagerie of his wild beasts. We've got a guy claiming, I mean, as you've already played in this hour, a guy who says that his head is made of the same material as the sun. And there is so much language in Walden where, you know, a halo of light over my shoulder and the sun is but a morning star. And there's so much language about the way that sound works at a distance and the way sound works underwater. And that's a key element in our plot as well. So it's just all those bizarre coincidences.
Ominous and serene fugue moments. And then moments at a pig farm. Here's a bit with the sampler character in the film, played by Andrew Sensenig, and a veterinarian played by David Little, examining two pigs that are linked through all this organic business to Chris and Jeff.
Won't let anyone near them. This crowd back in the corner.
Come on.
Violent.
Oh, yeah. He's got a litter on the way.
They can get very protective.
I've never seen the parents behave, so just never had them break my damn fence.
And you're off to the pig farm. Upstream Color, Merrick in Colchester, Vermont. Merrick, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to ask about your musical composition technique, because I was listening to some of the pieces on the radio, and it reminded me of extreme time stretching software, and I was wondering if you could discuss a little bit of your compositional technique.
Yeah, sure. By the way, if anybody wants to listen to it, it's at the website, upstreamcolor.com. You can listen for free, or if you want to buy it, whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the music, I tend to write music while I'm writing the script. And so that's what I did this time out. And it just sort of helps me. It's a confidence building exercise, because if I can, you know, if I have a scene or a moment that I'm imagining in my head, and I know what we can do with cinematography, and I know something about the story. And then if I can get a piece of music that supports all that and sort of mix it together in my head, then I know that, okay, great, we can get to that moment. We can execute that. So let's start building on it. So by the end of the writing process, I end up having something that I think of as the score. And then, you know, on this film, what happened is as we got closer and closer to production and the cinematic language became more and more specific, and we saw how effective things were going to be visually. And then, you know, Amy Simon shows up in town and we see how effective she's going to be carrying, you know, the lead character through the film. It changes some things. And there was something wrong about half of the score that I had written, and I couldn't put my finger on quite what it was until I realized that everything that we were doing was doing a really effective job of conveying the subjective experience of the characters on screen and sort of a tactility that suggests some curiosity. But the half of the music I'd written was way too orchestrated and meant to frame the mind of the audience, which is not the same thing as the mind of the characters on screen. Mm. And so I had to throw half of it out and regrow it. And I rewrote the music, and it was more ethereal and more subjective, and is, you know, essentially what it is now. And yes, you're asking about the time stretching software. I think what you might be keying into is the fact that we started grabbing sounds from locations and incorporating them. I would turn them into an instrument and then make that instrument part of the orchestration of a piece of music. And I don't think there's anywhere on the score that you could necessarily point at and go, oh, that's a sodium light humming underwater, whatever. But that is what's in there. And so the hope is that there is sort of a texture to the score that's appropriate to just being out of reach, that there's a sound that's just familiar enough, but not quite. To know what it is, because all those samples are layered throughout the score.
Mark Olson, there's something almost unique in my experience here with such a polymath, sort of one-man production, where one mind can be driving so much of this film, including being on screen and the score and the direction. And, I mean, maybe this is something that can only be produced through such a singular effort, Mark.
Well, it's interesting, you know, every time you've been listing off all of Shane's credits on the film, you've been leaving off a pretty important one, which is that he is, in fact, also the distributor of the film. I mean,
yes.
He's putting it
even
in
that.
The theaters himself. And that in and of itself is interesting. And I mean, and again, the way that, I mean, one of the things with Shane, I think, is that he simply just asked the question, why? Like, why is it that the process of filmmaking happens in this way? Why does he need a big team around him? Why can't you just put your movie right into theaters right after premieres at a festival? And so in some ways, he's like, it's interesting that he, in sort of, you can say a one-man band, but I think it also is maybe more appropriate to just think of him almost as like a sort of a garage yeast winemaker, someone who's just kind of doing their thing on their own in the way that they want to, and then sort of allowing the rest of us to share.
Do you mind? I'd love to say something about
yeah.
that. I receive so much benefit from this idea that I'm this one man band or whatever. But I mean, the reality is like right now we're in the middle of distribution, and Meredith Burke and Casey Gooden, who are both producers on the film, are tirelessly, you know, helping with print traffic and managing all sorts of the things that we have to do. I mean, it's a real operation. There's a theater booker called Michael Tuckman out of New York that's been hired, and he's been wonderful booking theaters. We hired national and regional PR. So I just want to make sure that, you know, this is a, you know, it necessarily is a machine of some kind where there are lots of us involved. It's not like I'm calling up theaters and saying, hey, can I send over a print?
I guess we understand that, but at the same time, you understand how much of your fingerprints are on so many parts of this film compared to so much of what we see out of American film these days.
No, absolutely, yeah.
How did you talk, let's say, to Amy when you say, well, here's the mood we want to establish in this film? Or how'd you direct her to find her pose?
Well, the wonderful thing about Amy is she's a filmmaker in her own right, which is why I asked her to be in the film. I was doing my due diligence looking for the proper actor for this because it was going to be so important, obviously, because she's in almost every scene.
Yeah.
And so I called her. I'd been given her name, and I called her up. She was in Florida where she lives, and she had written and directed this film called Sun Don't Shine that's actually coming out in a few weeks. And she let me see a little bit of it. I didn't really know what we were talking about because I thought she was an actress, and here we are talking about a film that she's editing. But I went along with it, and it turned out to be this really amazing film. And I got about 10 minutes in and decided that whoever it was that made this already gets lyricism and the way that it works in film. So if I can convince her to come on board, we are going to have much thriftier conversations than typical. And so really, she came to town, we started shooting, and I'm sure we had many conversations about exactly what we were doing, but to be honest, I just think she sort of got it.
There's a lot that is intuitive here, a lot that is lyrical. Shane Carruth is writer, director, producer, actor, composer, distributor of Upstream Color, with us today from Dallas, Texas. Shane, good luck with the film and with more to come. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Of course. Thank you, Tom.
And Mark Olson, film writer at the Los Angeles Times. Wonderful to have you, Mark. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
There's one last piece from the score for Upstream Color, again, composed by Shane Carruth. This one called, a quote from Henry David Thoreau's Walden, "After soaking 2 years and then lying high 6 months, it was perfectly sound, though waterlogged past drying." I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.